Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel, the editor of the TLS. Alongside me is Italian Chatelaine and TLS commissioning editor Thea Lenarduzzi.
I wish I were.
Chatelaine. I thought Italian Chatelaine sounded...
A castle in Italy.
It sounded lovely, didn't it?
Just an apartment.
Now, Thea, we've been discussing that we want people to review this podcast on iTunes so more people will hear it, but apparently my infrequent and slightly perfunctory requests have not been enough to get people to do it. So, we've got a challenge. Each week, for at least 2 or 3 weeks until we all grow tired and forget about
No, it's the enthusiasm that's the problem, Stig.
All right. So we have a challenge each week. We'd like you lovely listeners to leave a review on iTunes in a particular literary style. So we want to challenge you. So we're going to read out the best next week and each time. So this week, we're going to start easy on the literary styles, but I think we might get harder as we go along. We'd like you to review this podcast in the form of a haiku. After all, we were the podcast that had a whole item on Hispano-Welsh haikus. Do you remember that, Thea?
Of course.
Very good. So here's mine. I wrote one. Do you want to hear it?
I am going to.
Nice to hear about that Thea Lenarduzzi's feudal landholdings.
Ever more absurd these intros will surely be. Don't encourage Stig.
That's very good. Everything's a haiku, really. But you can do
I
better.
I sounded like Yoda.
Yeah, exactly. You do sound like Yoda. You can do better. Make sure while you're there, you subscribe to the podcast feed. If you want to subscribe to the paper itself, just Google TLS subscriptions and type pod1 in the offer code for the best deal. Right, on to this week's show. This month marks the 100th anniversary of partial women's suffrage, the decision to award women over the age of 30 with certain land qualifications the vote, an act of good sense achieved by all sorts of pressures, including the experience of the First World War, the direct action by the suffragettes, and the more peaceful protests of the suffragists, a distinction we will be exploring with Emmeline Godfrey. And the TLS this week has a focus on politics and economics more generally. That includes a very fine piece by political commentator Zoe Williams on the future of the British left in the era of that canny old disruptor Jeremy Corbyn. She will be in the studio to foretell what happens next for the Labour Party and the country. It is fast becoming a political cliche that we are living in exceptionally febrile and excitable times, times in which fundamental change is always on the horizon. And yet, looked at one way, the two-party axis of our politics has seldom looked more stable. Even though the Conservative government lurches from crisis to crisis, unattributable briefing to open dissent, it still appears to command the confidence of around 40% of the populace. Labour, under its messiah-like dissident Jeremy Corbyn, whose decades-held ideas seem to have found their movement, is stubbornly supported by another 40%. And the polls are kind of static on this. This is a funny sort of revolution, perhaps. But as Zoe Williams writes in her review of a number of political books this week, the country still seems ready for new ideas. Even, one might say, if they aren't good ideas. Brexit. In fact, says Zoe, the ideas don't have to be new. They could be as old as your grandparents, nationalise utilities, or as old as time, get rid of foreigners. But they have to be radically discontinuous. So these are momentous times. What do they mean for the Labour Party and then for the country? Zoe Williams is in the studio now. Zoe, welcome.
Thank you. Hello.
Where to start with this? Are the political conditions that brought us Brexit, which is often seen perhaps wrongly as a right-wing movement, are they the same conditions that ultimately will bring us a Corbyn government, do you think?
I certainly think that there's a kind of discontent which feeds both agendas, definitely. And I think, obviously, there is a left-wing Brexit. There's a Lexit, which is another story. I think the forces driving Brexit were, in terms of the kind of underlying conditions, they were essentially squeezed public services, stagnating wages and outrageous rents. And that is a story that could drive anything. Anything could basically pick up the reins of that. And it's just, from my point of view, very, very unfortunate, but not necessarily unexpected, that it was Brexit that managed to pick up the reins of that. But, you know, the idea that when Brexiters say now, we were never that anti-immigration, they're kind of right, because immigration was only ever a mechanism by which to connect the basic features of people's daily lives to the anti-European agenda, which of course has very little on stagnating wages, except for the fact that most of the anti-zero hours contract stuff came from Europe.
But isn't there a problem for Corbyn in that he seems to be zeitgeisty on all the things you're talking about, on the austerity problems, on stagnating wages. The point where he divorces himself from a lot of disenfranchised people is exactly that of immigration. He's very pro-immigration, he's pro-widespread immigration. He has this very internationalist view, which is very common actually to the Labour Party, which is that all people are deserving of support and help, whereas there's a whole core demographic of people saying, not everybody, yeah. I want just local indigenous people to get this help. And that seems to be a gap between his rhetoric and some of the people he thought would otherwise support him.
Well, I think I have a lot of response to that. Firstly, you know, he is on the internationalist wing. He would never have done one of those controls on immigration mugs that Ed Miliband did. And no. Ed Miliband was a kind of sympathetic person, but he was very easily led.
Well, Gordon Brown said English jobs for English workers, didn't he?
He did. It was that weird speech he gave, we're best when we're Labour, and then gave a kind of slightly weird protectionist pre-Trumpian Trump statement about English jobs for English workers. So, yeah, I think Jeremy Corbyn has a more stable moral centre on whether or not you make immigrants the kind of core of your, whether or not you allow them into the eye of the storm. Because the truth about the conversation about immigration is that you can have a lot of conversations about immigration, but if it's the first conversation you're having, it's always toxic.
Yeah.
So, you know, if it's the sixth conversation you're having and you're saying, is there a way where you can kind of distribute to more prosperous areas so these places don't quite take the hit, then that's different. But if your conversation starts, can we afford any more foreigners, it always ends in quite an ugly place. The thing about Corbyn is, as you say, he's always been very pro-human rights, so he's very pro-Refugee Act, so he's very pro all that. And actually, I don't think people have a problem with refugees. I think if we talked about them as a disaggregated block, people in desperate need of help, to which
really
we are signatories. Oh, yeah. I mean, the truth of it is, if you say to people, I mean, in the end, if you say, and this is the same across Europe, if you say, look, we've all signed up to this, we've all signed up to taking some people running in fear of their lives. At the moment, Africa's taking almost all of them and they haven't got any money. You can sort of get it passed. The problem.
I want to believe that, but I had a phone-in show on LBC for 3 years, and I've had that conversation. And
but you know,
it's very striking. There's a big bunch of people who just say, "Not our problem. Not our problem. Not our problem."
The thing is, if you look at what Lakoff says about the biconceptual self, everybody's got a generous self and a tightwad self. Everybody's got an honest self and a dishonest self. Everybody's got two moral selves, actually, and it's the kind of language you use to tap into the self that elicits the response. So if you're constantly saying we can't afford them, and then you ask people what they want, they say, well, we can't afford them. But the other thing I think happened, and I think this has been really key in the change of rhetoric around immigration, is that there's been a really sustained attack on the economically unproductive English person. So, you know, maybe you're disabled, maybe you're on benefits, maybe you're on maternity leave, maybe you're ill. But there has been a sustained attack to the point, I was talking to my stepmother, who is on the trustee board of Rethink. She said mentally ill people are now treated, all the bureaucratic language, she used to work in the prison service, is the way they used to talk about prisoners. It's like, you know, finding the balance between punishment and rehabilitation, finding the balance between incentive and disincentive. And they're talking about people like criminals, and people on benefits and in a kind of poverty class, whatever that poverty is driven by, have been recharacterised as criminals by the political debate. And in that context, immigration is absolutely poisonous, because you think, hang on a second, I'm being absolutely shafted here. I'm being treated like a criminal for not being well enough for work, and that Polish family is welcomed in because they're economically more productive than I am. You know, where's the compatriotism there? Where's the solidarity? Where is the social togetherness? And so I think really
that's a problem for Corbyn, though, isn't it?
Well, it is. It's more of a problem, I think, I think it's more of a problem ultimately for the benefits demonising class, which is the Conservatives, really.
Well, or it splits into two. I mean, that's what thing we see in this country. This is a country that's riven in two.
But we don't have to talk about people like that. And I think the thing is...
Well, no, of course you don't,
At the moment we do. But I think the thing is, I think Corbyn's part of the analysis that is most important is, you know, we don't hate people just because they're poor. And that did come across very much post-Grenfell. He could walk around that council estate and people would hug him because they knew that he didn't despise them. And that, I think, in that context, you can say a lot more about immigration than you can if you already despise the bottom 20% of your populace.
Did you have a Damascene moment with him? There must have been a point where, like everybody, you thought, whatever, right or wrong, he's not going to get, he can't have enough traction. He's a bad thing for the party. Did you have a moment where you converted?
No, I had like the opposite thing, which was the minute I saw his offer, I knew he was going to win. And I was just kicking myself so much for not having put a bet on. I know that's a really mercenary thing to say, but I wrote bloody columns about it saying, you know, I can see Blair's optimism in him. I can see his... Blair's certainty in him. I can see so much of Blair in Corbyn, which the others don't have. They look so depleted, so exhausted post 2015 election, yeah. So empty of ideas. Mary Craig was trying to stand for Labour for leader for a little while on the ticket of free bus fares for 16 to 18 year olds. And I remember hearing that and just dropping my head to the desk, which I would never do because it's rude, but it was so unambitious. And then he came in with boldness and vision and a things can only get better spirit. And you hadn't seen a Labour leader like that since Tony Blair. So I always thought that he was going to walk Labour leadership. And I always was slightly sceptical about the whole, it's unrealistic, he can't count, blah, blah, because frankly, nothing has ever costed. The Conservatives always pretend they're costing.
No,
it.
I know.
It's
yeah.
never costed. So I never minded about that, but I did have a huge wobble after the referendum, and that's why I'm always a kind of critical friend in the Corbyn lot rather than an actual friend, because I did think he could have been better. I think we all could have been better at fighting to remain. But I thought he especially could have been better.
He didn't, but actually, again, I mean, whatever else you might think, he tends to stick to what he believes in.
I know,
I know he campaigned for Remain, but he is a Brexiter. And I just, in the end, though, does this not damage him as much as it damages the Tories? Because at some point, there's going to have to be a consensus in the Labour Party as to what Brexit position they should hold. Well, there has to be. I mean, I know he's putting it off as long as possible, trying to make it a Tory problem, which it is because they're in government.
Yeah, but he doesn't realise at all, and I think this is key, that it's going to be the problem of whoever's holding the baby. But you can be blaming Cameron until you're blue in the face, but if you're Prime Minister, when jobs go through the floorboards, it's your fault.
And holding the baby is this a kind of key phrase in that as well, because we're talking about the youth vote.
Exactly. So if he does manage to mobilise this youth vote and get swept in by it, and then he lets them down on Brexit. There was a YouGov poll this morning showing that Labour absolutely hemorrhaged young support if they didn't come out in favour of Remain. Now, I think that's serious enough, and that will give them pause when they're doing their election strategy. But much, much worse than that would be if young people voted for him on trust that he would get us out of this
mess. They may have done, because, you know, I remember the old, when he went to Glastonbury, and the old Jeremy Corbyn. Yeah. And I remember saying on the radio, you know, what happened if he just walked out and said, you know what, I believe in Brexit. I think the EU is a stitch-up of corporate entities, which he always has. He didn't want to vote to go in. I mean, he voted against going in 1975.
I think if he said, I believe in Brexit, there would definitely, I think there would just be then bitter, bitter wrangles between his youth support, which would be tragic, because...
How does he square this circle? Because if he says, I don't believe in Brexit, comes out as Remain, all those northern working class people who felt they could trust him enough on Brexit meant they didn't, when they left UKIP, they didn't go to the Tories, they went to Labour, that he hemorrhages in another direction.
Well, I don't know if that's true, you see, because actually Labour is majority, even though 7 out of 10 Labour constituency are majority Leave, 6 out of 10 Labour voters, or 6.5 out of 10 Labour voters, are majority Remain. And I think what we're talking about really is a cephalogical point about who you throw to the wolves there.
Yeah.
Because you have to throw someone to the wolves, and do you actually do what your supporters want and then try and mop up constituency votes? Or do you kind of try and game the numbers and keep the constituencies? I mean, I think there's a moral case to be made here. You know, everybody's talking about hard Brexit and soft Brexit now as though that's like the bad option and the good option. Soft Brexit is disastrous. Soft Brexit is we lose all our rights, in all our kind of say over everything, but we keep being governed by them. And soft Brexit just squares us up for a hard Brexit further down the line, when we wake up in 5 years and say, hang on a second, we're still taking EU law. It's just now we can't even frame it.
I think this is what we're always going to do. This is classic Britain, I think, that we're going to spend years and billions of pounds and massive amount of wasted effort and end up with something that looks a little bit similar to being in the EU but isn't.
Part of me even wishes that was true, because I think we're going to end up with something that looks a bit like it but is much less good, like much less good. Then when we find out how much less good it is, we have this horrible rigmarole all over again and end up with something a lot less good than that. That's.
Do you think that if Jeremy Corbyn were to say, OK, you want radical, this is radical, I'm going to stop Brexit, I'm going to campaign to stop Brexit and reverse it, well, before it's even started properly, what do you think would happen? Do you think there's any chance that people who would have voted another way would come to the Labour Party?
Oh,
do you think that
God,
would make up
would
for the loss?
Yeah, I think it would be absolutely massive.
He'd never because do it, though. He doesn't believe it.
Well, no, I mean, look, Jeremy Corbyn, as he said, and I believe him, he was 7.5%. out of 10 Remain. I mean, he has got Remain bones in his body.
He's still able to be persuaded.
Yeah, exactly. He does want a jobs first Brexit, and there isn't a jobs first Brexit, which means...
That doesn't mean anything.
There isn't a variation on Brexit that actually delivers British jobs. So if he does want a jobs first... I think he's perfectly persuadable by the unions. Perfectly persuadable. And I think he always has been persuadable by the unions, and I think the unions are fronting up to persuade him. But I do think, as you say, anybody would be scared of the electoral consequences.
Yeah.
The benefit of Corbyn, of course, is that he does not care what front pages say. So they could go Hertz van Rental and it wouldn't make any difference.
But also, I don't think he doesn't care so much about being elected, in the sense that he'd presumably risk it for a sake of principle, wouldn't he? I mean, everything he's done so far has suggested he's not compromised on very much.
I don't know about that. I think he's pretty keen on getting
elected. Now he can see it. Can he taste it?
I mean, I think there is a kind of real sense that it's closer to happening than it's ever been. And
but why is this different from the 80s? I think that's a really interesting point.
Okay, yeah. No,
So this is the hard left, as was called.
Yeah.
Corbyn really does represent that, and has done since the 80s.
Yeah, and
I think... That was never considered electable.
No.
And now it is. Are they changed, or have just circumstances changed?
Well, I've been thinking a lot about this because I've also been thinking about the failures of my generation, which I think is not you two's generation. So I'm not calling you failures. But there's this thing called the father-son cycle, where you have very radical fathers fighting injustice, then completely inert, indolent sons who got bored of the injustice. And then the next generation is a new father generation. And I think that's what happened to those of us who were young in the 90s. We were so sick of all that 80s wrangling that we were like, post-irony, post-modern, everybody's middle class, nobody needs to worry about this anymore, that we don't need old industries, why don't they just go away, just go on the sick, don't worry about it, we can afford it. Like a completely apolitical, post-ideological, sort of useless phase, which is partly what has brought us to Brexit, because there haven't been any kind of competent middle-aged people in charge. It's all crazy pensioners and Jacob Rees-Mogg. I mean, Jesus. But anyway, I think when I look back
Prime
on
Minister.
When I look back on the kind of contortions and constipations of the left when I was young, the stuff that really put me off it and made me very kind of disco and primal scream in the 90s, there was a kind of structural problem with class. It was a Labour movement. It was meant to be a party of the working classes, but middle class people had already slightly co-opted it, and Labour activism, certainly in London, was very, very middle class, but it was on behalf of working class people. But it was a kind of co-opted movement, and there was kind of constant... It was very gestural. It was very aerated. A lot of people kind of, you know, trying to prove their working class credentials or apologising to the working class that they weren't working class enough. Or I remember loads of awful, wrangly conversations about whether this guy should join the House of Lords. Obviously, it's bad to be a hereditary lord, but then he would be the only left-wing one. So should he, shouldn't he? Maybe he should give his expense account to a homeless person. You know, and all that kind of... All that real, and it was kind of genuine embarrassment and shame and anxiety around having appropriated a Labour movement, and the Labour movement no longer being a kind of a pure, solid voice of working class as we knew it, together with the kind of destruction of the industries, which was kind of Thatcher was, she didn't care about our constipation. She was just doing it, just going for it. So you had a kind of complete betrayal of the actual working class at the same time as everybody middle class was really worried about having taken their party.
Which kind of created the perfect base for Tony Blair to come along and say, we're all middle class.
And so he comes along and says, we're all middle class. And everybody's like, oh, thank God. Now I don't have to have a middle class person telling me they're more working class than they are. And I don't have to look at a working class person and feel guilty for stealing their movement. And, you know, we're all friends because we're all the same and we're all on the same side. And it was kind of bullshit, right? Because the structural problems that
persisted
and got worse. It got worse and worse and worse. And all of the things that we thought represented an end of those problems was really just a kind of debt bubble or a post redistribution by tax credit. And, you know, I get into a lot of trouble when I say that because loads of people really love tax credits. But I was looking at all this stuff and what Tony Blair represented and the kind of failures of what he represented. And then I thought the really interesting thing about Corbyn now is that he does it, that young people don't understand that kind of, they don't understand that stuff because you get a middle class young person and they can't afford their rent either. Yeah. They're not getting paid properly either. I know, I've got a kid who dog sits for me, he's got 2 degrees and he's working for Deliveroo and he's really genuinely up against it. They're all screwed by housing, they're all screwed by student debt, they're all screwed by low wages and intern culture and 0 hours. They're all screwed in exactly the same way. And they do, and this is what Phil Burton Cartledge says in the Corbyn Effect book. He said people call this a youth effect or a youth quake, but actually it's a cohort class effect. We're looking at people subject to the same economic peril voting in the same way. And that is actually not like the 80s. That is much more like the 40s. The last block working class vote for a Labour Party was Clem Attlee. And so I look at Corbyn and I still think, I mean, I'm still furious about Brexit, obviously. I still think there are problems with the way he listens and responds and moves and is agile. But I am looking at somebody who has a cohort class support base, which a lot of people are desperate not to understand, but it's as plain as the nose on your face, I think.
So the next Attlee.
That just ends with me sounding like I'm threatening old people, Tory voters. I'm really not. No. I don't want anybody to die, but, you know.
Well, actually, Corbyn voters are getting older and older. There was a thing that said that the average age was like 30 at the beginning of the election campaign. It was 45 by the end, because that cohort you're talking about actually goes all the way up to 50 probably now. It's no longer just 20-year-olds. So you lured me into talking some more. We've got to stop because otherwise we'll get shut up. Zoe Williams, thank you so much.
No problem.
Anyone with even the most cursory interest in current affairs would have noticed that we've just entered an important anniversary year. It's 100 years since British women won the vote. Except, of course, it isn't, and they didn't. More accurate would be to say that it's 100 years this month since some women, about 40% of the eligible population, those over 30 and meeting the property qualifications, got the vote. Not until 2028 can we celebrate women, regardless of class, being granted the right to vote on the same terms as men. I point this out not to be churlish, not to suggest that the winning of the vote, even for just 40%, wasn't and isn't something to celebrate, but rather because its simplification of the history continues to skew things now, affecting the way we commemorate the suffrage movement, but also how we conceive of the future, you know, of what is left to be done and how best to act on it. There is an important difference, for example, between suffragists and suffragettes, which is why not everyone is happy about a statue of Millicent Fawcett due to be unveiled in Parliament Square in April. Not everyone sees that as a victory. Why? Emmeline Godfrey joins us in the studio now to explain.
Hi.
Hi. I mentioned that statue there of Millicent Fawcett. Following a petition by the activist Caroline Criado Perez, the suffragist leader, Fawcett, she'll be the only woman to join 11 men already standing in Parliament Square. So, I mean, that is an achievement, to be sure, but the petition asks specifically for a suffragette. Why does that distinction matter?
Well, the suffragettes described themselves as militants in a new kind of form in the 1900s, as distinct from the suffragists who had been campaigning in the 19th century in a kind of polite manner to Parliament by sending in petitions, by holding meetings. The suffragettes said, no, okay, that's really not worked. We've been waiting decades and decades, many petitions later. We need to take some direct action and we need to make the subject newsworthy.
The term suffragette was coined by a Daily Mail columnist.
Daily Mail, yes.
As a criticism, wasn't it? It was a kind of a deliberately sort of mean-spirited term.
Yeah, it was kind of to distinguish them as women who were, in a sense, you know, a bit sort of petty-minded, a bit silly, a little bit frivolous, you know, like the term leatherette, you know, that kind of thing. It's not it's like it's a sham. It's not the real thing.
But then they reclaimed it, did they?
They did, yeah. And indeed, Christabel Pankhurst founded the magazine The Suffragette, and she actually described the suffragettes as very much forward-thinking women. And initially, the name was actually pronounced suffragette, you know, we're going to get the vote.
Yeah.
So with a hard G rather than the soft G.
Did they, I suppose it's despised too strong, did they look down upon the suffragists as too polite, as people who, if they were to just dominate the movement, it would never get anywhere?
I think to an extent. I think some of them are very grateful for the suffragists to have raised public consciousness in the 19th century to the cause. But I think by the 1900s, especially Mrs. Pankhurst, I mean, she was getting a bit impatient. You know, she realised that yet another meeting with, you know, the politicians, polite meetings where various suffrage organisations would get together and put forward their views politely, that just wasn't really getting anywhere. You know, they had to do something to, you know, make this a newsworthy subject, to, in a sense, almost inconvenience the public a little bit, make some noise, make them notice.
And so I suppose the decision to have a suffragist as the subject of the statue in Parliament Square, that's very much a conscious choice to not reward what is defined as terrorist behaviour by some people.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the suffragettes, well, many of them weren't, it didn't necessarily always go into, you know, the kind of terrorist types of activities. Many of them continued on, for instance, holding meetings, again, perhaps smashing one or two windows. They didn't necessarily all go and blow up buildings or, you know, set fire to, you know, sports stands and things. They didn't all do that. But I think having the statue up to Millicent Fawcett, that really makes us aware of the hard work that was done before the suffragette campaign, and also that it was done during that too. So, for instance, you know, there's a book that's recently coming out by Jane Robinson, and she looks at the suffragists and all the campaigning that they were doing, and they put themselves through a lot of dangerous activity, and the public heckled them and threw, you know, various missiles at them as they were trying to say, you know, we're not going to burn anything down, we're not going to smash anything up, we just want to campaign peacefully for the vote. And it's to kind of appreciate that that was going on at the same time.
I'd never heard of the Great Pilgrimage of 1913.
I've not met anyone, when I've talked about this, I've not met anyone who'd heard of it either.
Yeah, so tell us about that.
Well, I think Jane Robinson's book's marvellous, because actually it's not really something that many people know about. The Pilgrimage was a response to a lot of the militant campaign that was going on by the suffragettes. They were ladies who went on the pilgrimage to show people that they were peaceful. You know, they wore, instead of the purple, white and green of the Women's Social and Political Union founded by Emmeline Pankhurst, they wore red, white and green to actually show, you know, that they were suffragists. It was, in a sense, a more reasoned kind of argument. You know, we're going to come to meet you where you live, you know, meet you on street corners, you know, village squares, on various roads, you know, that kind of thing. We're going to come to you and we're going to persuade you in a very civilised way to grant votes for women, because it makes sense, and we're not going to just smash up windows and kind of get, you know, publicity like that. And so this pilgrimage, you know, there were many different routes that they started out from, different parts of the UK, and they all converged on London. Afterwards, you know, one of the politicians was actually saying, well, you know, I think actually you might have a point. So I think actually they kind of gained some ground there.
Well, did the suffragettes alienate some people? I was reading a story about one of them when they slashed one of the paintings, not the Rugby Venus, but another painting at the Royal Academy. And a man saw the woman doing it and actually said, good for you, this is a good thing. And the crowd gathered and punched him and sort of threw him to the ground because he was supporting what was seen to be this very disconcerting social movement, the suffragette movement. From the remove of history, are we saying that it was a necessary thing because it unsettled people, or did it put people off who otherwise might have joined the cause?
It did put some people off. Initially, some who were very vocal in the campaign, for instance, the novelist Elizabeth Robbins, she wrote the first suffragette play and The Convert, which was a novel that was kind of derived from this play called Votes for Women with an exclamation mark. She was very vocal in the campaign and very good friend, you know, of Emmeline Pankhurst. And then eventually she thought, this isn't quite right, the direction that we're heading in. So even kind of high profile members like that definitely did. But it's interesting that you mentioned the attack on the man who was supporting the attack on the work of art, because sometimes people could actually get support for the cause, suffragettes, and indeed their male supporters sometimes found in these meetings that, say, somebody would heckle at them or be abusive towards them. Somebody else in the audience would think, well, that's not right. Perhaps that guy's got a point. Perhaps women do need the vote. Really? So it also kind of worked like that, too.
So this was necessary. I mean, if they hadn't adopted these militant tactics, is it too simplistic to say there wouldn't have been the vote in 1980?
I think they really helped to raise the awareness, but I think also some of the skills that they needed, the organisation, going out and actually putting themselves at risk, you know, stepping out of the home in many instances, you know, some came from sheltered backgrounds, and that really gave them some of the skills that they use to, you know, undertake the war work. And I think that, and some suffragettes did actually in their memoirs say, had it not been for my experiences, you know, working with the WSPU or, you know, the NUWSS, National Union of Women Suffrage Societies, by Melissa Garrett-Fawcett, then, you know, I wouldn't have been equipped to deal with war work.
I think one of the virtues of your piece, you've reviewed a number of books in it, and it really sort of shows how mosaic the whole movement was. And
definitely,
there does seem to be a tendency in memorialising, commemorating things like this, to kind of gloss over and say that they're all part of the same kind of coherent movement. And these books, I mean, they really bring the personality back to history, don't they? So
that's what I actually loved about all five of them. They were really outstanding in their all different ways. And I think it would be kind of unfair to compare, say, Professor June Purvis's book, which is an academic book aimed at an academic audience, to say, you know, Robert Wainwright's book, which is very much for a popular audience. You can buy it from the high street.
So June Purvis's book about Christabel Pankhurst, and Robert Wainwright is about the airborne suffragist Muriel Matters.
Muriel Matters.
The elocutionist from Australia. Yeah, brilliant.
Well, tell us about Christabel Pankhurst then. Why? Because she sort of is a figure in need of rehabilitation.
Oh, yeah. I actually loved this book. And the reason I loved it was because, you know, some of these films that you get where, say, you don't know anything about the subject at all. Say, for instance, the film about Ayrton Senna and Alan Prost. Yeah. Or, you know, again, you've got James Hunt versus Niki Lauda at Rush. You don't have to know anything about Formula One at all to understand this kind of, this duality, this duel between the two figures. And what June Purvis really beautifully sets up in this book is the conflict between Sylvia, you think you know suffrage history by the way that Sylvia's told it, and Christabel, hey, look at the texts again, go back, you know, look at the school reports, look at the letters, let's reevaluate Sylvia's version of things. And I thought that was really bracing and actually fantastic, you know, addictive read based on
this. So who was Christabel then? Where does she fit into the story?
Well, Christabel was the kind of the ostensible favourite of Emmeline Pankhurst. She was one of the key organisers of the Women's Social and Political Union, setting it up with her mother in 1903. She was also qualified as a lawyer, but she wasn't allowed to practice at the time. And she was always seen as a kind of a show lady. So, you know, she'd get on stage and she'd wear beautiful dresses and she would just speak very confidently to the audience. And, you know, she knew how to deal with hecklers. She was very authoritative, but she could also, as a number of critics said at the time, you know, could be a bit cold. And especially the way that, you know, in 1912, she and her mother are depicted a lot in history of getting rid of the Pethick Lawrences. And the Pethick Lawrences were key figures in the Women's Social and Political Union. They really kind of treated Christabel like a daughter, in a sense. They were very close to her. And there was a decision taken that, you know, they were very rich, but they were a liability because they had so many assets and the government could go after them. Every time they were jailed and every time there was another, you know, campaign, the government would sort of try to seize their assets. And Mrs. Pankhurst, as June Purvis is saying, you know, she, okay, decided to get rid of them. But Christabel really had qualms about that. And June Purvis asks us to remember this, that it wasn't just something that, you know, Christabel decided to coldly do. It was really something that bothered her at the time.
Because Emily, I read a thing saying that she was said in the 50s, when people were looking back on her, to be like a cross between Lenin and Hitler.
Oh, goodness.
Because she was...
Very interesting,
she was
yeah.
seen as this very yeah. tough figure, wasn't she?
Yeah, and actually there was a piece that I was reading about. It was one of the... I believe it was the mayor of Cape Town, and she was involved with the suffragette bodyguard that protected Emmeline Pankhurst from rearrest. And she was talking exactly about that in about, I think it was the 1940s or so, 1950s. And she said she very much compared Mrs. Pankhurst, the way that she got her audience into the subject she was talking about, almost as a kind of a mesmeric kind of way. Yeah. And she led like that in a sense. And she said it was actually a little bit, you know, a little bit uncomfortable in a way too. Although she admired her, she saw that kind of ruthless streak in her.
Today is the day that actually commemorates, it's 100 years today of having this conversation of the vote. One of the talking points has been, should we pardon? I think there's an MP who said they want to try and get for pardon for all the suffragettes who committed crimes in pursuit of getting the vote. Do you think pardoning is a worthwhile thing to do?
I don't know. I know that many decades after the ladies were involved in the campaign, a number of them actually said in press interviews, oh, by the way, you know, I'm still actually meant to be serving a jail sentence. And decades later, you sort of see them as older ladies and, you know, it's kind of difficult to sort of see them as, you know, criminals who were quite dangerous at the time and a massive security hazard. And I think there's so many decades have passed since then, since even those interviews too. I'm just wondering if, you know, I don't know if it necessarily is a necessary thing to pursue in my kind of...
Defang history.
I
somehow.
Think that's exactly, yeah.
It's almost like a bit of a pat on the head somehow.
They committed crimes because they had to in order to make the point. If you then take away their criminal record, in some ways that takes away part of their protest. Their protest was that they had to go and they felt they had to go and do this stuff. I don't suppose they were looking for... Would they be? I mean, who am I to say? But it feels like saying, "Oh, it wasn't a crime," when it was a crime, and they had to commit a crime in order to make the point.
Yeah. But then also the other aspect too is that some of these crimes were very serious and could have turned out, you know, quite badly. I mean, Diane Atkinson, she mentions the attack on Lewis Harcourt's house in 1912, and she said, you know, there were about a dozen people or so in the house, and that, you know, something could have gone seriously wrong there. So I mean, do you kind of, in retrospect, pardon kind of crimes that are on that level that were kind carried on afterwards? And of course the other thing people tend to forget is that it was a massive security headache for the special branch, because at the time, you know, there were so many political assassinations.
Yeah, Irish nationalism was very high at
the
time.
Oh gosh, yeah, and the, you know, the link with Fenianism too. And you get that other sense of perspective when you look at the police opinion on what was going on. You for instance learn that it's actually quite a scary thing if a lady came up to a politician and, you know, just started heckling them, because they didn't know what the women were going to do, given the background of all these assassinations.
I said, well, you can't rewrite history, I think. Because the parallel people said with people who were convicted of homosexuality. But that seems to me, so if you're born gay, you shouldn't be convicted for it. These crimes were actions by people who felt they had to take those actions, and we can say they were forgivable and they were morally acceptable, their actions, but to say that they weren't crimes when they were recognisable crimes and they would be crimes today miss the point.
Well, that's the other thing too, because I think certainly in the last 10 years or so within suffragette history, a number of scholars have pointed out that, you know, a number of these crimes, they would be considered as terrorist acts today. So I think that's something to bear in mind, but not all the women engaged in those. No. That's another thing also to mention. And then the more you delve into it, the more complex it becomes. And then, you know, it's just simply the definition of suffragette and suffragist. And then you've got militant suffragist, which is, as one of the authors was saying, was the, you know, the Women's Freedom League. So again, it just kind of breaks down until you think you've understood it, and actually all these books, as they've shown in their own different ways, no, you haven't. You need to relook at something which you actually thought was written about and discussed copiously, and you need to go back and look at it again.
That seems like a fitting way to end it. Really.
Sorry, I was going to mention as well, Kitty Marshall.
Because have you written a book about her?
Well, I'm writing a book on Kitty Marshall, who was actually the lady who was one of the key people responsible for the statue of Emmeline Pankhurst that you'll see in Victoria Tower Gardens today.
Ah.
and she was a very good friend of Emmeline Pankhurst. She was on her bodyguard team, assigned to protect her from rearrest under the Cat and Mouse Act. So she learnt skills in jiu-jitsu. And
to stop people getting too close to Emmeline?
Well, to stop the police rearresting her under the Prisoner's Temporary Discharge of Ill Health Act, a very clunkily kind of phrased law that was passed in 1913. And she lived in Essex with her husband, Arthur, who was a lawyer for the Women's Social and Political Union. And he risked like his reputation and also, you know, he sometimes got into some of these confrontations too. He actually sometimes got her out of situations as well, came and got her at one point from an island in the middle of, I think it's sort of near Parliament Square, an island of traffic, and he just sort of got her out of that.
Did he do jiu-jitsu too?
I don't know. That'd be interesting. It'd be interesting to imagine.
Did she ever use the jiu-jitsu?
She doesn't actually mention it in her memoirs, but I imagine that she probably had some kind of basic skills in it. As I said, her memoirs are wonderful and they're kept at the Museum of London, as well as the necklace that she created to commemorate her Spates in Jail, which is exhibited as part of the Museum of London exhibition that's gone on just now. And my book is going to be called Kitty and the Cats, Mrs. Pankhurst's Suffragette Bodyguard and the London Police. So I'm also looking at it from a slightly different angle as well.
That sounds really fun.
We can see that passion on a final note in your choice of bangles today. Green, purple and white.
Oh, yeah. I've been making a lot of these recently.
That's a good spot. Even as you were talking about green, purple and white, that didn't connect. I'm useless. That's really all we have time for
this week.
I think we could have talked about both of these things.
Absolutely. And they come together as well in a way that we would have to have a whole other show for.
Stop talking. Thanks go to Zoe Williams and Emmeline Godfrey. If you want to read more from the TLS, do go to the website or buy a copy of the paper. This issue also covers both the American left and the American right and has a piece on kissing by Kristin Rupinian, the brilliant author of The Cat Person short story. And I have reviewed the new Julius Caesar at the Bridge Theatre in London, which is really, really good. If you have a chance to go and see it there, you really like it. Go and wander around while people get assassinated. It's very good fun. We also have a special extra podcast for you this week. Michael, the Dr. Keynes, will be interviewing the novelist Gregory Normanton, so check that out. And do remember to review this podcast this week in the form of a haiku. We shall read the best next week, I promised. Next week in the TLS, we will be considering the American character with published lectures by Marilyn Robinson and Edith Wharton. The latter definitely won't be on the podcast, alas. Until next week then, from Thea and from me, goodbye.